fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
It is Easter Friday. Friday in the octave of Easter. That means that you can eat bacon. It's a solemnity. And we need to rejoice. Even if you don't feel like you deserve it, you really don't deserve it. We don't deserve God's grace. But he's giving it to us anyways. He wants to bless us. This is Easter. So it's just one big Easter day, this octave of Easter. Thanks for joining me. We're going to kick off your weekend in style. I can't wait to share what I've got for you today. But if you want to call in, 1-888-914-9149 is the toll-free number to call. 1-888-914-9149. It's toll-free. Calls on me. You can also email the show, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And I'm on Twitter, too. My handle, grab onto it, is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We also have a show account, too, at Cale Clark Show. Check that out to be sure. Well, as I mentioned, I was going to give you the final piece of the minimal facts argument. There are five facts that virtually all scholars, even if they're atheists, even if they're agnostics, even if they don't believe in Jesus at all, they all agree that these are facts. And I think when you put them all together, it makes a great case for the resurrection. We've been leaking out a lot of these facts throughout the week. We talked about Jesus' death by crucifixion, which is verified by a lot of historians, even outside the Bible, secular historians, people who are not Christians at all. They've got no axe to grind here. Well, maybe they do have an axe to grind because some of them are outright hostile to the Catholic faith. We talked about the empty tomb. We talked about the physical appearances of the resurrected Christ, that he is, in fact, corporeal. He's physical. We talked about how the hallucination theory doesn't work. We talked about Paul's conversion. If we have more time, we'll get into that a little bit more. But the one I wanted to talk to you about today was the conversion of the skeptic James, the so-called, quote-unquote, brother of the Lord. Who is he? Is he, in fact, another son of Mary? The answer is no, and I'll explain why as we go along. But there's a famous archaeological find that has to do with James. Perhaps you've heard of it. I'm going to tell you about that right now. I tweeted a picture of it earlier if you want to check my Twitter account. It is quite a tale. And Herschel Shanks, who recently passed away, we talked about him on a previous episode of the Cale Clark Show. He was the founder of the Biblical Archaeological Review magazine and website. Wonderful guy. Lived in Israel. Did so much to really promote knowledge of the archaeological discoveries that helped buttress our understanding of the Old and New Testaments. At any rate, he got a phone call at 10 a.m. on Friday. It was November the 1st, 2002. And this was a call that he was very, very worried about. On the other end of the line, talking to Herschel Shanks, was Dan Rahimi, who was director of managing all the collections at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, the city where I live. It's one of the greatest museums in the world, the ROM, as it's known, the Royal Ontario Museum. And the James Ossuary, the bone box, the limestone bone box, 2,000 years old, purported to be the very box that contained the bones of James. And it even said there was an inscription on the box that said, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. We're going to explain what that's all about in just a minute. And that was on its way to the Ontario Museum in Toronto from Israel. However, there was some bad, bad news. And Dan Rahimi said to Herschel Shanks, I'm really sorry. I hope you're sitting down. We've got a problem here. It turned out that in shipping en route from Israel to Toronto, and this made international news, this 2,000-year-old relic. And was it real? Was it authentic? That was a big point of debate. It still is today. This ossuary, this bone box, was covered in cracks. In fact, it actually cracked in five separate pieces. One of the cracks went right through the inscription that was on the side of the bone box. Poor packing job, I suppose, but this was a disaster. The silver lining was that somebody who worked at the Royal Ontario Museum Iva Zetovich was a world-class restorer of stone objects from the ancient world. And she took a look at this and she said, I can rebuild it. It was a little bit like the $6 million man. I can rebuild it. And she did. She was able to put it back together as best she could. And really, she did a great job considering what kind of shape it was in. She did a fantastic job putting it back together. And this made front page news, not only the fact of the ossuary itself, but also how it got damaged and put back together. And soon it was on display at the Royal Ontario Museum, and people came from all over the world to see this. There were lineups that were hundreds of people deep to get into the building. An archaeological relic relating possibly to Jesus? This was unbelievable. In fact, if legitimate, this would be literally carved in stone, maybe the earliest reference to Jesus. Not to mention James, and we'll talk about who he was in just a moment. But I remember Dr. Craig Evans, who's been on the show before, lots of leading biblical scholars came to see this in person, and they talked about it and they discussed it. Was it legitimate? Well, let me tell you about this James, because there are a lot of people named James in the New Testament, and I'm going to share with you later how Jesus specifically appeared to him after Easter, gave him a personal appearance after the resurrection. Why did he do that? We'll talk about that soon. But let me just tell you who he was exactly. Now, according to the New Testament, there are the quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus. And I'll explain who these guys are. One of the places you can find this is when the Gospels talk about Jesus preaching in a synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth. And people are amazed at Jesus. And that tells me a couple of things. Number one, Jesus was a pretty quote-unquote normal guy growing up. Nobody thought, wow, this is the divine Son of God as he's growing up in Nazareth. And that actually shows us that a lot of these apocryphal legends from these apocryphal Gospels that came out quite a bit later, and we talked about this earlier this week in the 2nd century, 3rd century, fantastic tales about Jesus turning bullies to stone. There's one ancient story about a soccer game that took place on a rooftop. A kid falls off the building and dies. Jesus brings him back to life. None of these things happen. Jesus did do miracles, but not when he was growing up. That seems to be the case, because what do the people say when he's preaching in Nazareth? Where did this man get this wisdom? Where did he get these mighty works? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas, here with us? Are not all his sisters with us? Matthew 13, verses 54 to 56. We also see the Gospel of Mark with something very similar, almost identical, but the order that the brothers are mentioned is a little bit different. It talks about Jesus in the synagogue and the mention of the brothers, James and Joses, and Joses is a variant of the name Joseph, and Judas and Simon. That's in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. And by the way, when it talks about Judas, that could be the person who wrote the letter of Jude in the New Testament. Now, as you can imagine, the name Judas kind of had some connotations. Judas was actually a pretty popular name in the first century, but it seems that this Judas may have changed his name to Jude for obvious reasons. I don't want to be associated with that guy, and came to be known as Jude. But Jude, anybody named Jude, that's where it comes from. It's basically Judas. And so who are these people? Now, obviously, as Catholics, we believe in the perpetual virginity of Mary, that she is semper virgo, ever virgin. And this is a point of Catholic doctrine. You have to believe this to be Catholic. And by the way, just to set your minds at ease, there is nothing in the Bible that contradicts the Catholic faith, and there's nothing in the Catholic faith that contradicts the Bible. Nowhere in the New Testament does it say that Mary had any other children other than Jesus. Okay, so just keep that in the back of your mind so that you're not at all thrown if you hear talk of the quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus, which of course are mentioned in the New Testament. So I'm going to lay this out for you, and so just draw a mental picture in your mind here. these are the four options about who this James, and not to mention James, but these other quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus, who are they? Well, if you're a secular person who doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in the supernatural, and maybe the people in the synagogue at Nazareth when Jesus was preaching might have thought this way, some people think that these brothers and sisters are in fact full siblings of Jesus. In other words, Mary married Joseph, and they had a family together. They had lots of kids. Jesus was one of them. That's the secular view. That's not the Catholic view. There's also what I would call the main Protestant view. Now, not all Protestants believe this. Some Protestants actually believe more of a Catholic view on this, but this is the half-brother view. And this is very common. Perhaps you've come across this. So a lot of Protestants explain this away by saying, okay, well, God, of course, is the true father of Jesus, doesn't have a human father. Mary gave birth to Jesus, and then afterwards, after the virginal conception of Jesus and the birth of Jesus, then Mary, of course, continues, Mary's has been married to Joseph, and then they have other children of their own. So in other words, these are half-brothers. They have the same mother, different father. Jesus, of course, his father being God, and these other children, quote-unquote, the father would be Joseph, according to this view. But again, this is not a Catholic view. You can't hold this view as a Catholic. So there's two more possibilities for who these guys are. And one of them is, now these are both compatible. The last two I'm going to give you are both compatible with being Catholic. The third view is the stepbrothers view. The stepbrothers view. And this is held by the Orthodox churches. People from an Orthodox background, they'll likely hold this view. Also some Eastern Catholics, some Eastern Rite Catholics, they're Catholics, they're part of the Eastern Rites, maybe they're Melkite Catholics or Ukrainian Catholics or whatever. Eastern Catholics, Coptic Catholics, that'd be Egyptian Catholics. A lot of Orthodox believers and Eastern Rite Catholics hold the stepbrother view, and this would be that Joseph actually had a previous wife who had died, and that all of these children, these quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus, were children of Joseph from his previous marriage. His wife had passed away, and Joseph was an older widower who married Mary, not to have another family with her, but to be her guardian, to be her protector, and that Mary was a consecrated virgin. She was always planning on being a virgin, which is, in a lot of ways, it does make sense of Luke's text when, in the Annunciation scene, when the angel appears to Mary, and it already says she's engaged. We know this already. She's engaged to Joseph. And the angel says to her, you're going to have a son, and he's going to be the Messiah. And she's like, well, how's this possible? I'm a virgin. Well, hang on here. You're engaged. You're about to get married. Don't you know where babies come from? No, she says, no, I'm a virgin. So that implies that she's made some prior vow of virginity. So that could help explain this. So that view is compatible with the Catholic faith. There's another view, and this is sort of the majority view in the Western part of the church, in the Roman Rite. Most Catholics are Roman Rite Catholics. The name of the church is technically the Catholic Church, but it's often known as the Roman Catholic Church because, obviously it's headquartered in Rome. Secondly, most Catholics are what we call Roman Rite Catholics. And so in this view, these quote-unquote brothers and sisters of Jesus are cousins of Jesus, first cousins, second cousins. And some people think that they're actually children of Clopas, who's mentioned in the New Testament, and Mary of Clopas, his wife. And some people think that Clopas was Joseph's cousin. Okay? Joseph and Clopas were brothers, rather, and that so these kids would be cousins of Jesus. All right, so those are the four explanations. So if this ossuary is authentic, and it is, in fact, the quote-unquote brother of the Lord, James, if it belongs to James, then the stepbrother view would come into play here. If he was a son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, but not from the same mother, a brother from another mother, if you will. So anyway, so there is dispute about whether or not this ossuary is authentic, and I'll talk about that. Actually, I might as well talk about that right now. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. There's a lot of Jameses in the New Testament, so it's super confusing. I will explain a little bit more about who this guy really was and what he did, which is very important in just a minute. But just to talk about the ossuary a little bit, this ossuary, and you can Google it on Twitter, or Google it on Google, rather. You can check out my Twitter feed. I posted a picture of it. The inscription that's on the side of this bone box, and by the way, the Jews use these for secondary burial. We talked about this a lot this week, leading up to Easter, and last week too on Good Friday. When a year after the body has been buried, the Jews would go back in the tomb, collect the bones, the flesh has decayed by this point, and they would do a secondary burial. They'd gather the bones, put them in a bone box made of limestone and ossuary, and that would then be the final resting place. They'd put the ossuary in a niche in the family crypt. Why did they put the bones together in a box? It sounds almost too simple, but it's the reality of it, because they wanted to make it easier for God to put you back together again at the resurrection on the last day. That was one of the reasons. I'm not kidding. But this bone box belonging to James, it had an inscription on the side in Aramaic. And this is where one of the cracks, you know, when it broke in transit, went right through this inscription. And it said, Yaakov bar Yosef, which means son of Joseph. Yaakov bar Yosef. Yaakov is Jacob, but it's also could be translated as James. Yaakov bar Joseph ak hui de Yeshua. And Yeshua is Jesus. So in English, it would be James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And so there's been all kinds of talk about whether this is authentic, whether this is real. The discovery of the ossuary was announced by the Discovery Channel, along with the Biblical Archaeology Society, Herschel Shanks, on October the 21st, 2002. Now, the Israel Antiquities Authority, they're the guys who look at all the artifacts that you know, get discovered in Israel, and they judge whether or not they're authentic. They're in total control of all this stuff. The Israel Antiquities Authority, led by Professor Yuval Goren, they were quite doubtful about whether or not this was authentic. And so they actually took the IAA, the Antiquities Authority of Israel, took the owner of the ossuary, who was a guy named Oded Golan, they took him to court, and they accused him of forgery. They said that he actually carved that inscription on the box. And there was a huge court case that ensued. There was a trial that lasted for over 5 years. There are more than 12,000 pages of court documents that came out of this trial. 138 witnesses were called to testify, including all kinds of experts from archaeology. And on March the 14th, 2012, the judge, who was, his name was Aaron Farkash of the Jerusalem District Court, he made his ruling and he cleared Oded Golan, who owned the ossuary, of all charges of forgery. So a lot of scholars said, yeah, this is authentic. Some didn't. And people still debate whether or not it's real, whether or not this actually belongs to James, the quote-unquote brother of the Lord. Well, who was this guy? Who was this brother of the Lord? And when did, now we know he's not a son of Mary, but who is he? And when did Jesus appear to him in his resurrected body after Easter? I'm going to answer all those burning questions after this short break. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Be right back. Welcome, friends. Relevant Radio so proudly presents The Cale Clark Show, a tradition unlike any other. And you know what else is not like any other? Our Master's Update, which we do every day during the Master's Update segment of the program. And now I'm going to bring in Patrick Galog. Patrick, how are our favorites doing today? I must say this first of all, though, Patrick.
Yes.
Augusta National Golf Club, which you visited. I'm going to get into that in just a moment. It's known for its beautiful azalea flowers, but it seems that today, once again, just like yesterday, a rose is blooming among the azaleas. Justin Rose is still leading the tournament at 7 under par. We're going to throw it to Vern Lundquist now. No, we're not. But
who I met, by the way, too.
Oh, you did.
That's another story.
You did. Wow.
I'm just coming up with stories today, and I...
Have you ever in your life seen anything like that? All right. But how's John Rahm doing today? How's Rombo doing?
Oh, yeah, my winner pick, or at least my favorite pick, John Rahm, is 8 behind right now, plus 1. He's got a couple holes left to go.
So Siwoo Kim.
Siwoo Kim, my dark horse pick. He is tied for 6th, 3 behind.
That was an incredible pick, by the way. An incredible pick. He had 100-1 odds against, you know, winning this tournament, and he's right there. He's 3 shots back. Siwoo Kim from South Korea.
Of course, if I put money on him, you wouldn't have done well.
Sometimes, you know, the Lord wants you to trust in him and not try to make your living in Vegas, that's for sure.
Correct.
Now, I had my favorite, and I had my dark horse candidate as well, Justin Thomas.
He's also minus 4. Tied with Siwoo Kim.
Yeah, I tell you, he's not too far off, and I wouldn't bet against him this weekend. And my dark horse pick, who I thought was majorly disrespected, Colin Morikawa, he's now at minus 2, right?
Correct. He's only 5 behind. He's tied for 13th. So it looks like three of our 4 picks are in the hunt, and we'll see what John Rahm does as well.
Yeah, 3 of the 4 in red figures, not too far off the lead. It's going to be an exciting weekend at Augusta National. And you tweeted a picture today that you had been there. I don't know if you got onto the grounds.
No, I did not. I mean, I had an ex-girlfriend who lived in Augusta, and this is several years ago. And I said, hey, is there anything, you know, that says like Augusta National? And she said, this is the only sign. It's on Twitter. It's on my Twitter at Patrick Alog.
Yep.
And it's like really just one little puny sign.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's it. Everything else is pretty. It's pretty hidden.
So is that sign like sort of right outside Magnolia Lane?
I don't even know where Magnolia Lane is based on. Okay. Yeah. So it was outside. So that's like the one little sign.
Magnolia Lane is the road that you drive down to get to the clubhouse, and obviously that's pretty exclusive.
And right after this program, I'll tweet that out on the Kel Clark Show Twitter as well. So
yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. It's a great picture, and obviously that young lady, it's her loss. That now you didn't date her just because you wanted to get close to Augusta National, did you? And did she pick up?
No,
on that?
No, okay. It was just one of the perks. But anyway,
okay,
no,
right.
No. That was it did not.
Well, speaking of sports. And this has something to do with morality, I think. Last night in the game between the New York Mets and the Miami Marlins, Michael Conforto did something that was a little bit sketchy. He got the quote-unquote game-winning RBI by allowing himself to be hit by a pitch in the strike zone. So let's hear some audio from actually the Mets broadcasting team, including Keith Hernandez.
Coming and the slider in there, strike 3.
Hit Conforto. He made no effort to get out of the way. It was a strike, but he didn't move. And Don Mattingly is going to come out and argue the call with the home plate umpire Ron Culpa.
The ball hit him, and it was going to be a strike.
Yep.
So the Mets are celebrating, the Marlins are arguing. And unless this is overruled, the Mets have themselves a 3-2 win as Conforto is nicked by a pitch.
What are they saying?
They're saying the play stands. Game's over. The Mets win it.
Wow.
Now, what's amazing about this is that the hometown Mets broadcast team thought this was terrible, which I think is great because this is really against the integrity of the game. So if you're hit by a pitch, you generally are awarded a base. It's just like getting a hit. But there are exceptions. If you get hit by a pitch that happens to be in the strike zone, which was the case here, this pitch was going to be a strike, that is supposed to override getting hit by a pitch. It's supposed to be called as a strike. If you get hit by a pitch outside of the strike zone, but you didn't make any effort to avoid it, that's supposed to be ruled a ball. You're not supposed to get credit for that either. So I am really upset that this happened. The ends do not justify the means, Michael Conforto. Now, he was not apologetic at all. The Mets were obviously celebrating on the field, and when interviewed after the game, he said, hey, a win's a win. I don't know about that. How do you feel about this, Patrick?
You know what? It's disappointing what Michael Conforto did, but I'm a little more disappointed in umpires not, you know, not making the right call. Granted that he took advantage of the rules, Conforto, and maybe after today we'll see if other players try to do the same thing. But I have a feeling the umpires are going to have a little discussion about this. Maybe they already did.
I think so, because according to replay, the only thing replay can confirm is whether or not the guy actually got hit by a pitch, which he did in this case. But it's totally the umpire's judgment call as to whether or not it should be a strike. And it certainly should have been. And this is not a good look for Major League Baseball, to be sure. The integrity of the game has been called into question. And just there's just, in all the, with all the corruption going on in modern society, we don't need this in baseball. We look to baseball, you know, and obviously there has been obviously scandals in baseball. Let's face it. There's the Black Sox scandal of 1919, the movie Eight Men Out, of course, memorialized that. Say it ain't so, Joe. Shoeless Joe Jackson, his role in that potentially. Obviously the steroid scandal of recent years. The Astros cheating scandal a little closer to home with banging on trash cans. But everybody sees this as being a mar on the game. And I was at least comforted by the fact that the Mets' own broadcast crew called them on this. This is terrible. This is no way to win a game, to be sure. It's a really bad look. Really bad look. I remember when I was a kid watching baseball growing up, there's this guy who played for the Boston Red Sox, Patrick. His name was Don Baylor. He was a DH, and he was a pretty big dude. He would always do this. Whenever there's an inside pitch, he would just like turn his back to the pitcher, and he would allow the ball to hit him in sort of the fat part of the back, right underneath the shoulder blade. And I'm sure it still hurt if it's going 90 miles an hour, but he would just sort of absorb the blow, and he would get so many hit by pitches by doing that. He wasn't really trying to get out of the way. But this guy, I mean, Conforto was totally egregious and so obvious what he was trying to do. It was just a real Bush League play. It was really disappointing.
Cale, by the way, interesting stat when he said that about Don Baylor. Fourth all-time in hit-by-pitch.
Yeah, but that makes sense because I saw it happen a lot when he was playing for the Sox back in the 80s. Well, way back in the first century, way, 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 way back, a lot farther back than the 1980s, of course, there was James, the quote-unquote brother of the Lord. Now, don't worry, he wasn't a son of Mary. But who was this guy? We talked about his ossuary. And as I said, this is really the last piece of the Easter puzzle in terms of the five facts that all scholars agree on, no matter what their persuasion is, whether they're Catholic, Protestant, atheist, agnostic, belong to some other religion, they're one of the nuns, they don't practice anything. All of them agree on these five minimal facts: Jesus' death by crucifixion, the empty tomb, the disciples claimed that Jesus rose physically from the dead and appeared to them, the conversion of Paul, we talked a little bit about that. Nobody questions the fact that Paul became a convert. We have writings from his own hand. They're known to be authentic letters of Paul. He talks about what he did, why he did it, why he converted. And then we have the conversion of James, who was also skeptical prior to Easter, and then he gets converted. He becomes a follower, and he also becomes the Bishop of Jerusalem and a martyr. So where do we read that Jesus appeared to James? Well, we see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6. And this is part of the Corinthian Creed that I told you about before. And when it talks about the appearances, it says, "Then he appeared," Jesus appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. "Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles." And then Paul says, "Last of all, he appeared to me." So 1 Corinthians 15:7 is where it talks about the appearance to James. Now, it's interesting too that Paul says that when he, after his conversion, he travels to Jerusalem, where he saw nobody, none of the other apostles, except for James, the Lord's brother. And that's in Galatians chapter 1, verse 19. Now, this is the same James who presided over the famous Council of Jerusalem. I guess you could say, we talk a lot about Vatican II. This was the first ecumenical Catholic Church council in Jerusalem, which happened in about the year 49 AD. And there was a big issue that was to be discussed. Do Gentile converts have to be circumcised and obey the Jewish food laws, the so-called ceremonial works of the law, if you will, in order to become Catholics? And the answer was no, they don't have to, which obviously helped the spread of evangelization quite a bit from a practical point of view. And so James is presiding over the Council of Jerusalem. In Acts chapter 15, you can read about this. And so James is sort of the host of that event. And he talks about, you know, what their decision was, that Gentiles didn't have to be circumcised. They don't need to follow all the dietary laws, but they had to refrain from impurity, from unchastity, from sexual immorality. They had to refrain from eating meat that was sacrificed to pagan idols, meat that had come from an animal that was strangled, and also from consuming blood. And that's in Acts 15, so I guess no rare steak there. Anyways, Josephus also talks about James. The great historian of the times, the Jewish historian Josephus, who lived in the first century, his writings shed a lot of information on that time. And Josephus tells us a little bit about the death of James. There was a certain Sadducee, and he was so sad, you see. His name was Anan, and his father's name was Anan. So it's kind of like John and John Jr. kind of thing. Well, he's also known as Ananus the Younger. And he was the high priest for about 3 months in the year AD 62. Now, don't forget, for all the fights that Jesus had with the Pharisees, and he had a lot of them, they agreed on a lot of stuff. The resurrection of the body, all that sort of stuff. Well, Sadducees didn't believe in any of that. And don't forget, Sadducees were in control of the high priesthood. It was a Sadducee high priest, Caiaphas, who handed Jesus over to death, not the Pharisees. Just always remember that. At any rate, this guy, Ananus the Younger, was the high priest for 3 months in the year AD 62. And he reigned for a really, really brief time, but it was a violent time. And he actually called together the Supreme Council of the Jews, the Sanhedrin, the same council that condemned Jesus to death. And Ananus the Younger had several people given over to death, commanded that they be killed. One of them was James. James was stoned to death. And Josephus called this high priest, Ananus the Younger, he called him insolent, very rigid in judging offenders. And the Pharisees were really ticked off that he had all these people killed. And the Pharisees actually asked the Jewish king Agrippa II to remove Ananus the Younger from the high priesthood. And I believe that actually did happen. So this guy was a bad dude. He was the guy who condemned James to death. We also know a little bit about James's martyrdom from an early writer named Hegesippus, who was an early writer in the church. And he talks about how James, and by the way, this is he's the one who tells us that James's nickname was James the Just. That's another moniker by which James is known, James the Just. And you might have heard this story, that he was said to be excessively righteous. Is it possible to be excessively righteous? I don't think so. As St. Jose Maria said, hey, the more holier you are, the happier you'll be. Maybe you just wanted to be really happy. But James the Just spent so much time praying on his knees that it is said that his knees became as hard as the knees of a camel, just actually calloused all over by praying so much. How about that? Well, according to Hegesippus, James was martyred by being thrown from the pinnacle of the temple, which is usually thought to be the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. He was then stoned. If that didn't kill him, they then stoned and clubbed him to death. And Hegesippus tells us that James was buried right there, right where he was killed. And it's possible that his bones were collected and later placed in an ossuary. Now, this is interesting because St. James the Just, he's the patron saint of the Armenian Church. It's one of the Eastern churches. And when the ossuary was being brought to North America in 2002, the patriarch of the Armenian Church, Bishop Shirvanian, he actually said to a reporter that the bones of James, because people always ask, like, when the ossuary was there, what happened to his bones? What happened to James's bones? If we've got the ossuary, where are the bones? You'd expect to find them inside. Well, that's not the case, because apparently the bones of James were in a chapel in the Kidron Valley until the 8th century, and that chapel was eventually destroyed, and then James's bones were moved to the Cathedral of St. James in the old city of Jerusalem, where they still apparently are to this day. And so the bishop, patriarch of the Armenian Church, he said, you know what, when they discovered this ossuary, we said, this actually makes sense, because he thinks it's the same ossuary that originally held the bones of James, but they just got rid of it when they removed the bones and put them in the church. So I don't know. As I said earlier, there's a lot of confusion about all the different guys named James in the New Testament. There are several people named James that are mentioned there. Two of the 12 disciples, the original 12 apostles, are also named James. There's, of course, James, the son of Zebedee, who's known as James the Greater. Of course, his brother was John. They're the two sons of Zebedee, the Zebedee and Sons Fishing Company, the Sons of Thunder, quote-unquote, Boanerges, that's them. So there's James, the son of Zebedee, and there's another James who is one of the apostles, James, the son of Alphaeus. And he's known as James the Less or James the Younger. You can look up Mark chapter 15, verse 40, where it mentions him. So there you have it. So there's two sets of James. There's two James in the 12 apostles. This is super confusing. A lot of guys named James in the first century in Israel. It's a really popular name. So there are other people named James too, and it's super, super confusing for a lot of people. And at times I've been confused in the past looking this up. So you got to be really careful to keep them all straight. There might be as many as seven individuals with that name mentioned in the New Testament. And so that's a little bit of a background on who he is, his martyrdom. But again, he was converted because of the resurrection. He didn't believe in Jesus prior to Easter. In fact, if you read the New Testament, it seems like he might have even made fun of Jesus. In Mark chapter 3, when Jesus is preaching, and also in Mark chapter 6, it talks about his family. There's a time when his family comes, and this is probably his extended family. And I do think that, that James, although he's not a son of Mary, he might be part of the extended family of Jesus, whether he's a son of Joseph from a previous marriage. Maybe the Orthodox are right about that. And some Eastern Catholics, that's an interesting view. But I do think he may have been a relative of the Lord, although not a son of Mary. Jesus's family, they want to take hold of him. They actually think he's out of his mind. What is going on here with this guy? And that's where Jesus says, oh, who are my mother? They say, oh, your mother and your brothers are outside. They're looking for you. And Jesus says, well, who are my mother and my brothers? Everyone who does the will of God is my mother and brother. Now, of course, Mary did the will of God as his mother. So it's not a shot against Mary, to be sure. But also in John chapter 7, there's another interesting passage. And let me just look that up for you real quick. I'm going to look up John chapter 7 here. Bear with me. John 7. This is really, really wild. So it says this, and this is the Feast of Tabernacles is about to happen, a major feast of the Jews. It says, now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. So his brethren, and these are the quote-unquote brothers of the Lord, said to him, leave here and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see the works that you're doing. For no man works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For even his brethren did not believe in him. So in other words, they're kind of making fun of him. That's what some scholars think. Hey, you think you're the Messiah, dude? Well, why don't you prove it? Go to the feast. Go public. Make it public. Just go. Tell them you're the Messiah. Jesus says to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. Go to the feast yourselves. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. So saying, he remained in Galilee. Now, it's kind of funny because Jesus says, I'm not going. And then he kind of does go at the end. In verse 10, it says, after his brethren had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. They were looking for him at the feast and saying, where is he? And there was much muttering about him among the people. Some say he was a good man. Some said, no, he is leading the people astray. Yet no one spoke openly of him for fear of the religious authorities. So there you have it. So it seems like if he's one of these guys, he didn't necessarily believe in Jesus. However, something happened, and that was an appearance of the resurrected Christ to James. It's talked about in that Corinthian Creed, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 7. That changes everything. And then when you read the Acts of the Apostles, by the way, all these other guys, these brethren of the Lord, they now believe in Jesus, whether they're cousins or whoever they may be. They are in the upper room with the disciples and Mary after the resurrection. See Acts chapter 1, verse 14. And of course, I already told you about James became the bishop of Jerusalem, a leader in the church there. Paul actually reports on his activities to James when he comes to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 21. First Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5 also talks about how these brethren of the Lord became believers. And the only thing that really explains this is, of course, the resurrection. Jesus made a personal resurrection appearance to James. So that's what happened. And that would certainly change my mind. And it certainly changed James as well. It changed his whole life. Very, very difficult to think that this would have happened, been mentioned by Paul, unless it was true. Because, again, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing that this guy didn't believe in Jesus, and now he becomes an ardent believer. That's it. There's lots of different historical people not colluding with each other that wrote about him. The criterion of multiple attestation fits there as well. So there you go. That's the last piece of the Minimal Facts puzzle. Be right back on the Cale Clark Show right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester. Patrick wanted to play that song because he's super confused about who James is, and maybe you guys still are too, even after we went through that whole segment on James. A lot of Jameses out there. Right, Patrick?
Yeah, like which one? Are you talking about the apostles, the greater, the lesser? Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not. I'm talking about James, the Bishop of Jerusalem, the quote-unquote brother of the Lord, not a son of Mary, don't worry. But he's part of the James gang. As I said, there could be up to seven people named James in the New Testament. And here's an answer to a question that you asked me off air. Yes, it is true that this James who we're talking about, who Jesus appeared to after the resurrection, he wrote the letter of James in the New Testament.
No way!
Yes way! Yahweh, I guess you could say. At any rate, yes, he wrote that. So, one day I'd like to do an episode on that because that's incredible because he's really in that great wisdom tradition of all the sages. James the Sage, it would be a great episode to do. His letter is amazing. Good stuff there to be sure. Well, listen, I gotta mention really quickly, this is really my last chance to do this week. Divine Mercy is this Sunday, Divine Mercy Sunday, and you can join Father Rocky and Drew Mariani at 3 p.m. Central for a special live broadcast. They're going to pray the chaplet together. You can call in with your prayer intentions, and this will be your last major opportunity to claim a free copy of Drew's new book, Divine Mercy. So you can go to relevantradio.com/mercy to claim it. No shipping, no handling. And we don't believe in name it and claim it theology, but you can name and claim that book for yourself, which will help you to learn more about this feast. And it's just awesome. The greatest attribute of God is, of course, his mercy. So we're kind of through all these minimal facts about the resurrection. There's lots of things we could talk about, but these are facts that the vast majority of all scholars agree upon, no matter what they believe personally. And I think the only theory that fits all these facts is the reality that Jesus rose from the dead physically. That's the only thing that makes sense of all the data without having to shoehorn it and try to make it fit where it doesn't fit and try to put square pegs into round holes. The only thing that explains all the data that we have the best is that Jesus rose from the dead, in my humble opinion. I think all the other alternative theories fall flat. We looked at a couple of them this week. We can look at some more next week. We looked at the hallucination theory yesterday, how that doesn't work. The preposterous theory that the disciples stole the body, that doesn't work. There's a few more that also don't work. But the resurrection is real, and that does make a difference in our everyday life. And I remember my professor, Dr. Gary Habermas, who is one of the world's leading experts, if not the world's leading expert on the resurrection of Jesus. He's written 7 books about it. I remember when he was teaching me in my grad school studies about the resurrection, he told all of us the very personal story about how this all hit home for him. It was about when his wife, Debbie, passed away. She died of stomach cancer in 1995. And it was one of those things where they went to the doctor, and when they got the news, it just hit them like a ton of bricks. You're given a very, very brief amount of time to live, and it's quite shocking. And Gary Habermas told us that he used to just sit on his porch and just look off at nothing in particular. And at the same time, his wife was upstairs in the bedroom dying of stomach cancer. And except for just a brief period of time, she died at home, essentially. She was in the hospital for a little bit, but she essentially died at home. A terrible, terrible dark time in his life. And he told us what was really incredible was that his students would call him at home. And they would say this to him. They would say, "Hey, Dr. Habermas, you've taught us so much about the resurrection. At a time like this, aren't you glad that it's true?" And he had to laugh because he said, first of all, his students were trying to cheer him up with his own teaching. And he had to love that, of course. But secondly, it worked. It worked. The resurrection is what got him through that time. And he told us he often thought about the book of Job and how Job had all these questions for God. He went through all this terrible suffering. And God obviously turned the tables on him and started asking Job some questions, some very pointed questions. "Where were you when I created the foundations of the universe, huh? Were you around? You're asking questions. I've got some for you." And Dr. Habermas said that if God were to appear to him somehow, he would only ask him one question. He would only ask him one question. He would say, "Lord, why is my wife, Debbie, up there dying of stomach cancer upstairs in that bedroom?" And he would just imagine God asking him a question. I'm not saying he heard any voices. It wasn't a locution or anything like that. But just in his mind, he could imagine God asking him a question. "Gary, did I raise my son from the dead? Did I raise my son from the dead?" And he would say, "Oh, Lord, you know, I believe that. I've written 7 books about it. Of course, I think that it's true. But I want to know about my wife. Why did this happen to her?" And then he would just imagine God asking him that same question in response. "Did I raise my son from the dead? Did I do it or did I not?" And that was really the point for him, that because Jesus was raised from death 2,000 years ago, there is an answer to the suffering of his wife Debbie and really all the suffering in the world, that it's the answer. It's what we can put our hope in. And he still had really practical things he had to work through. He had 4 children that he thought he was going to have to raise all on his own. And Gary since remarried after that some years later. But he said, you know, obviously this is the most painful experience that he's ever gone through. And if the resurrection of Jesus could get him through that, it could get him through anything in his life. It works in the year 33 AD. It works in the year 1995, the year that his wife passed away, and it works in the year 2021, and it'll work until Jesus returns. That is the answer. One day, he will see his wife again, raised from the dead, just as Jesus promised. He will raise all of his faithful from the dead. We will have our own resurrection. And then, he said, "I'm going to see them both. I'm going to see my Lord and Savior Jesus risen from the dead. I'm going to see my wife again in eternity." And that's really where the rubber hits the road here. This works. It's true and it works. It's real and it can give you hope because it really did happen. This is not pie in the sky stuff, folks. The resurrection is reality. It is historical. And so that's it. We'll talk much more about this later. But I've really enjoyed going through this resurrection evidence for you in this Easter octave. It's been great. It's been great. And we'll have much more, of course, on Easter, in this Easter season, as we go along through the days and weeks to come. And so, Patrick, what are your plans for this weekend? I must ask you, my friend.
Well, I was planning to go do a little traveling downstate, but weather-wise, probably not going to. I was like, maybe I'll play golf, but weather-wise, it's not looking good. But definitely Divine Mercy Sunday, though. Definitely. I'm looking forward to that, though.
Divine Mercy Sunday. Yeah. I can't wait. It's so crucial that the world get this message. So please tune in to Relevant Radio for the Divine Mercy Sunday activities and pray the chapel with Father Rocky and our own Drew Mariani as well. And of course, I'm going to be watching the Masters. I will not lie about that. And maybe listen to some tunes Did you know, by the way, that, you know, I'm a big 80s music fan. Did you know that they found a lost album by Prince? Remember that? Remember that guy? Remember this song? Hey, that was Prince. A lot of messianic themes in that song. I Would Die For You. That's from the Purple Rain album, 1984. Well, they've discovered another album that he cut in 2010. And it's really eerie. He actually predicts a lot of things that are going on. Fake news, social media crazes, political unrest. It's really eerie. Prince, I'm not saying he was an Orthodox believer by any sense. He was actually raised in a Seventh-day Adventist family, and he became a Jehovah's Witness in the early 2000s. Anyways, may he rest in peace, and may you have a restful and wonderful weekend. Don't forget, Resurrection is Real, Divine Mercy Sunday coming up. Happy birthday to Timory. She's up next. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.